The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Wanna take a ride? Broadcasting from the sprawling outskirts of the Florida Everglades, in the intellectual wilderness of South Florida, the outer regions of humanity that people move to just because it doesn't snow. This is the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Friday. Nicole Sandler here at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network, as well as a wonderful internet radio station near you. Perhaps you're listening on Netroots Radio or one of the other great outlets that carry us, or the podcast, however you listen. I thank you for doing so. Today, if you are listening, for instance, on the Progressive Voices Network, you're getting the one-hour version of the program. And the show's usually an hour long. Today, because there's so much content to get to, it's going to be the extended disco version of the show. So we will run a little long on the live program. And also, the podcast. The podcast will be the entirety of the show. It will be edited down to an hour to air on the Progressive Voices Network tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern. But if you want to hear the whole thing, come on over to NicoleSandler.com or just subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Just know that my show is not behind a paywall. And I did it this way specifically because I know so many listeners are hurting still financially, even in this great Trump economy. Go figure. This show is supported by listener donations. It's 100% listener supported. So we do appreciate your financial support. Just if you can't afford to donate, it won't preclude you from listening. So anyway, today, if you don't normally get the full podcast, you may want to, because we got a lot of ground to cover. One of those things will be an interview with Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. I've been a fan of his for a long time. Today's the first time I ever had the chance to talk with him. He's actually on a plane right now, so we taped the interview about 2 hours ago. And I also already had Digby scheduled to come on and sort of recap the debates with us and figure out where we go from here. And Digby, you know, is one of my favorite people, let alone guests. So what I thought we would do, and we have all this debate stuff to go through, so a lot of ground to cover. So what I thought we'd do is we'll start off and listen to maybe the first half of the interview with Jamie Raskin. So you'll be enticed to either stick around through the end of the extended disco version of the live show, or, you know, come back later and get the full podcast. Whatever you choose to do, of course, is up to you. So we'll do that. Digby will be here at the bottom of the hour. There's lots of news to go through lots of information to impart. But I'll tell you what, let's start. Oh, I realize I did my little YouTube Chiron wrong, because recorded the interview with Jamie Raskin. Let's listen to that, and I'll get a show card up on YouTube in just a moment. We're just busy today, and that's a good thing. So Jamie Raskin, of course, congressman from the 8th District of Maryland, joins us now. You're currently serving your second term in the U.S. House of Representatives from Maryland's 8th District, and you've already ascended into leadership, which is really good because, I've been following you since you got into Congress, and I appreciate a real progressive who doesn't shy away from the difficult subjects. And the fact that you're in leadership is a good thing, because we need more like you in leadership. How is your working relationship with Nancy Pelosi?
But I think it's excellent. You know, I represent a district that's interesting because it has perhaps the most liberal county in Maryland, Montgomery County. It's got perhaps the most conservative county in it, Carroll County. And then it has a kind of a swing county, Frederick County. So, I am attentive to the politics of different kinds of regions, my public philosophy is decidedly progressive, but I get along well with Pelosi. But I was not appointed to the leadership by her. I was elected by the five most junior classes. So there are 165 junior members who elected me to be their representative to the leadership. So that gives me independent ground to stand on.
Nice. That's good, because frankly, there are a lot of us who, you know, bitch and moan to a degree about leadership of the Democratic caucus in the House and how it's run by people who've been there forever and who are not necessarily progressives. I know Nancy Pelosi's background is somewhat progressive, but it seems like she's veered more to the right in recent years, and it's a frustration. So seeing you, Jamie Raskin, and Ted Lieu in leadership positions is very heartening to people like me who want progressives, which, by the way, the Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in the House. We want progressives to have a bigger voice in the caucus. So glad to see that you're on the rise in there.
The Progressive Caucus is indeed the largest ideological caucus, if you will. But also, I think we have a progressive party. I mean, the heart of the word progressive is progress, and that's what the Democratic Party is all about. And no matter where I go in the country, I'm finding strong, true blue Democrats who want to make progress on all of the critical issues, whether it's war and peace or it's healthcare for the people or comprehensive gun safety legislation. I mean, that's where our party is.
Right. There's also sort of an ideological battle in the House. It kind of came to a head yesterday. Unfortunately, not the best results that could have happened. There was a bill that the House passed earlier in the week with a $4.5 billion humanitarian relief bill, basically, for funds for the border where we're seeing an unprecedented number of migrants coming up seeking asylum. Obviously, Donald Trump has just made a travesty of an already bad situation. This bill that the House passed had protections for the migrants, for the people being separated from their families, Unfortunately, what passed yesterday was the Senate version that didn't have those protections. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, again, our progressive majority on the House side passed legislation both to get immediate emergency aid to the children and the families suffering at the border under intolerable conditions. But it also imposed restrictive conditions on the private contractors, and it imposed much more accountability both on the government and bureaucrats, but also on any private entities that are now in the business of making money in this situation. Those provisions were stripped from the Senate version. And when it came back to us, it was basically take it or leave it from Mitch McConnell, which is the only way we get anything from him. I mean, mostly he just lets our legislation on the Equality Act, on environmental protection, on gun safety just sit on his desk. But here, the popular pressure forced him to move, but he basically said he would do the emergency aid, but he's not accepting any of the accountability measures or any of the other progressive provisions we'd added. And so we were looking at either nothing or adopting the Senate version. We adopted the Senate version. I voted against it. A lot of the progressives, I think more than 100 of us voted against it, to register our protest to what happened. But this is the price of having one half of one third of the federal government. I mean, we need to win the Senate back. We need to win the White House back, and we got to figure out a way to restore at least the balance of power, if not a progressive majority on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. So along those lines, talking about winning the Senate back, which I think has to be as much of a priority as winning the White House, because we know what Mitch McConnell has done over the last 10 years, which is block anything the Democrats want to do, while, of course, the Republicans scream that the Democrats are the obstructionists. It's their classic projection in its opposite world. But with that said, last night we wrapped up the first debate of the 2020 presidential primary season. It was a two-parter because 20 candidates were on the stage over two nights. On that stage, I saw a lot of people who, frankly, I would prefer, if it were up to me, that they would stay home and run for the Senate or remain in the Senate, because what's going on there is so important that it's got to be a priority to win back the Senate in 2020. What are your thoughts on the field of Democratic candidates and the prospects for winning back the Senate?
Well, I'm totally with you on that. I think that a bunch of our Senate colleagues despairing of any change under Mitch McConnell essentially derived the wrong lesson from it. They basically said, I'm going to go ahead and run for president to get away from here. You got to stay and fight, and you got to stay and organize. And, you know, people have to take other states as seriously as they take their own state politically, and they've got to take other districts as seriously as they take their own districts politically. So, you know, I'm in a good situation in a basically blue district in Maryland, but I created a project called Democracy Summer, where we put more than 100 high school and college students into the field in the 2018 campaign in Pennsylvania, Jersey, Virginia, Iowa. We had them out working, and I went and I joined them and I raised money for the candidates there. And I've got very close friends now who are the new representatives in Pennsylvania, like Madeline Dean and Mary Kay Scanlon and Chrissy Houlihan and Susan Wilde, and the same in Virginia with Jennifer Wexton and Abigail Spanberger and our Iowa friends. So, you know, not everybody's got to be president of the United States,
right.
And we shouldn't even lionize the presidency in that way. This is a democratic society. Congress is the heart of government. The president's sole job is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, not derailed and circumvented and violated. And obviously, this president's a terrible example of it. He's on a complete, you know, ego trip. But I don't think we should follow him down that road. Not everybody's got to run for president.
Right. So I'm guessing you watched the debates over the last two nights. Do you have any burning thoughts?
Well, I watched with actually our Democracy Summer 2019 young people, and we had some, you know, public events with them.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to send the message that, first of all, not everybody's got to run for president. You can run for Senate in your state. You're doing a great service doing that. You can run for the House and you can organize. But I was impressed by, you know, the breadth of our field and the commitment of our field. I think that this race is going to winnow down rather quickly over the next few weeks. You know, there are those who've been able to break through, and I think that it will be to everybody's benefit to have five or six candidates articulating competing public agendas and different theories of what the Democratic Party should be doing.
True. I fully agree. Do you have a favorite candidate at this time? Have you endorsed anybody?
I've not endorsed anybody. I mean, I've got multiple friends in the field, and I wish everybody well. But, I mean, Elizabeth Warren is somebody I've been close to, who's been out to my district, who supported me strongly. And so I stayed in close touch with her, and I've been very pleased about the growth and the development of her campaign, that, you know, she was able to get past Donald Trump's antics and provocations towards her to get to the policy substance that has been at the heart of her career. And I think America's starting to see what she's all about. So I'm psyched about that. You know, I was impressed with Kamala Harris's performance, you know, in the debates. I was impressed with Castro's performance in the debate. My next door neighbor, John Delaney, did well upholding kind of the conservative side of the spectrum. So, you know, I mean, there are people who are, you know, acquitting themselves well, but I think it's going to winnow down really quickly here.
As it should. And I'm with you.
Yeah.
I hope it does. There are a number of people. I'm glad we heard from them, but now it's time for them to go home. And maybe in the case of Beto O'Rourke, maybe he does go back home and decide to run against John Cornyn. In the case of Hickenlooper or Michael Bennett, you know, we can use them in the Senate, and I don't think either one of them is going to become president, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that. Congressman Jamie Raskin is with us, as you can hear. He is in an airport. Congress is going on recess. Next week is the 4th of July, so you guys are off for a week. Of course, yesterday we got the final rulings for this term of the Supreme Court. The two biggest cases were decisions were handed down, and it was unfortunately sort of a mixed bag. The American people won when the Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration cannot put a citizen question on the census, although Trump has already said he's going to see if they can delay the census because he's going to still try to get that question on there. Do you think he'll be successful?
Well, let's start with this. I mean, this case, in a legal sense, is an absolute slam dunk no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, three federal district courts said that it was completely clear that the stated reason for adding the citizenship question to the census was pretextual. It was a complete invention and concoction by Secretary Wilbur Ross and the Republican operatives who were motivated basically at reducing the number of Democratic-held seats and increasing the number of Republican seats, and basically, you know, nullifying the presence of non-citizens and minorities in the census. And that was perfectly clear. Even then, it was just a 5-4 decision. And miraculously, Chief Justice Roberts did the same thing.
Right.
And that may have been as much for camouflage for the terrible decision he participated in on gerrymandering at the same time, you know.
Right.
But look, I think that Trump is going to try his hardest to do double backflips to impose the citizenship question on America completely outside of the normal administrative process, outside of the rule of law. And I think that it's going to be a real struggle for us, precisely because you've got the Federalist Society that's run amok in the courts, and at least four justices who are willing to sign off on anything, including, Donald Trump's denials about the existence of climate change, or the latest woman he's sexually harassed.
Right. Or raped. No, I hear you.
And
you mentioned, of course, the other case, which was a massive blow to democracy and voting rights in the decision on partisan gerrymandering, where the Supreme Court basically said it's not our job. That's the way I looked at it anyway. It's oversimplifying it, but that's basically it, saying there's no role for the federal courts in determining how district lines are drawn in individual states. Did they waffle on that? Did they blow it on this question?
The five-justice majority, the conservative majority, again, declared it a non-justiciable political question, meaning that it's outside of the ability of the courts to decide. And it's got to be Congress or the states that deal with it. Now, in H.R. 1, the Democratic majority in the House did pass very important anti-gerrymander provisions. We said that there would be independent, nonpartisan redistricting panels in every state in the union to redistrict for congressional races. And that's clearly what it is we're going to have to do. The hypocrisy, of course, is replete on the Supreme Court, because it was the same conservative philosophy and basically the same kind of majority which formed in Shaw versus Reno and Miller versus Johnson to declare that so-called racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional. And those are districts where everybody's got a right to vote. Everybody's got a right to run for office. But you have an African-American or Hispanic majority, and of course that's too much for the right-wing conservative reaction that's taking place in the judiciary today. So those districts are presumptively unconstitutional now, and they had no problem finding that that was justiciable. In fact, they didn't even address the question of the political question doctrine when they looked at those cases. But when it comes to party redistricting, they're perfectly happy to let the Republicans run amok across the country. I mean, Democrats do it, too, but Republicans control a lot more state legislatures than we do. And so that's been a keystone to their power.
Right. And that's why, you know, a lot of people, I guess, don't realize it, but those two Supreme Court cases are very closely related, because coming up on the census, that is how they determine, who lives in a district and representation. Of course, the way that the Republicans were able to get so much control in after 2010 is because in 2010 they controlled the so many state legislatures, and they're the ones who oversee the districting. So now, if the citizenship question hopefully does not scare away too many minorities from answering the census questions, Democrats can get back more of that representation and maybe take over some state houses and control over the districting in their states. This is going to take precedence over how it goes for the next 10 years. That's why that question was so important.
That's right. There have been estimates that had the citizenship question gone through, or if it does go through, there will be an undercount of 6 or 7 million people.
Ooh.
And that will mean a reduction of probably 10 or, you know, a dozen seats that serve heavily minority Democratic districts, and a corresponding dwindling of Democrats in Congress. And that's what they're attempting to do, as well as to shift resources away from those communities, too. And, you know, gerrymandering is the process by which the politicians choose the voters before the voters choose the politicians.
Yes.
And the Republicans have made an art form out of it. In North Carolina, for example, where there. It's basically a 50-50 state, or really a Democratic state, but they've got 10 Republicans in the congressional delegation and three Democrats. I mean, it's just a scandalous situation, what they've done in, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio,
Florida,
Virginia, and so on.
Yeah, I live in Florida, so we see it here, too. There's many more registered Democrats in Florida than there are Republicans, yet they control the state government. Jamie Raskin, congressman from Maryland's 8th District, is our guest. A conversation we recorded a couple hours ago. He's, as you could tell, was sitting in an airport. He's now on a plane, which is why we recorded it. Actually, Jamie was supposed to be here yesterday to fill in for Hallie Klein, who is, took a couple of weeks off for vacation. But things got so crazy yesterday, he couldn't do it. So that's why today is backed up, and such is the life of a one-hour radio show, that today will go a little longer because we got a lot of stuff to do. We'll get back to my conversation with Jamie Raskin later on in the program, the extended disco version, because we've got so much other stuff to do. So I hope you stick around for that. Digby will be along in about 10 minutes or so to go over what went on in the debate last night. But for now, I figured we would start in and get some of the news of the day going out for you. We'll do it in our What's News segment.
I read the news.
So finally, we've passed a milestone, I suppose. The first debate in the 2020 presidential election is in the history books. 20 of the 25 declared candidates for the Democratic nomination vied for precious airtime during the 4 hours of questioning spread over the last two consecutive nights. We'll get to all that in a minute. First, what we were just discussing with Jamie Raskin, the Supreme Court officially ended its term yesterday, handing down the final decisions of the session, including the two biggest cases they heard this year. In one, a decision that could have severe electoral ramifications in a 5-4 vote on partisan gerrymandering, the Supreme Court ruled that federal courts have no place in settling fights over how district lines are drawn. We'll get a little bit more in-depth into this issue next week on the program. David Daley, who wrote the book Rat Fucked, which is all about gerrymandering, will join us, I think, on Wednesday. So we'll get into that. Then, in the other case, thankfully, Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the liberals on the court in rejecting the Trump administration's attempts to put a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Of course, Trump is fighting it. They're saying it's not a done deal yet. Originally, they said they needed to get the questionnaires printed at the end of this month. That's why this was the deadline. Of course, we know how they bullshit us. So we'll see. Trump is already trying to delay it. And let's see. Also covered in the conversation with Jamie Raskin, the Senate, this was just a mess yesterday. The Senate rejected the House emergency border funding bill because of the provisions added by the progressives that guaranteed the money would be used to raise the standard of care for the kids, the migrant children held in these jails, in these cages. Nancy Pelosi caved and brought the Senate-passed version without those protections up for a vote in the House, where it passed yesterday by a vote of 305 to 102. As you heard Jamie Raskin say, he voted against it, as did most of the progressives. Seems to me that Nancy Pelosi got played here. And so for all of you who keep saying, oh, she knows more than we all do about how to go about this, how to deal with Trump, bullshit. Nancy Pelosi is scared of her shadow. She's afraid to bring an impeachment inquiry because she's afraid it'll cause the Democrats to lose in 2020, in which case she'd be blamed. Well, you know what? We're beyond the time for the political ramifications. This president needs to be held accountable by the one body who can hold him accountable, the one body who has oversight responsibility granted by the Constitution, and that's the Congress. And if Congress doesn't exercise its oversight responsibilities, then what good are they? Nancy Pelosi needs to go. That's my thoughts on that. All right. And Donald Trump, of course, is in Japan for the G20 summit, where he already met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And there was a little press gaggle at which Trump said to Putin, "Oh, they're all fake news. You don't have fake news. You're lucky." And Putin said something like, "Yeah, we have fake. We do." And Trump says, "I wish we could get rid of all of them." These are despicable people. And one of the reporters again asked Trump, "Are you going to tell Putin not to mess with our elections?" And Trump said that it's hard to hear, but here's what he said. Yeah, sorry, you can't hear it. But basically, he like flippantly said to, you know, "Don't meddle with our elections," and shook his finger and said, "Don't meddle in our elections." Joking. It's not a joke, you fucking turd. Okay, now back to the debates. Night two last night, which featured four of the top five candidates, was certainly more spirited and contentious than the first night, which I believe Elizabeth Warren easily dominated. But it was Senator Kamala Harris on night two that had arguably the most game-changing moment, or 5 minutes, when the gloves came off and she challenged frontrunner Joe Biden on his record when it comes to issues of race and civil rights. In this case, it was busing. Obviously, the clip went on way too long. It's about a 5-minute clip. I'm not going to play the whole thing for you here. But here's a little sampling of the back and forth of that moment or minutes that kind of went viral.
On the issue of race, I couldn't agree more that this is an issue that is still not being talked about truthfully and honestly. There is not a black man I know, be he a relative, a friend, or a coworker, who has not been the subject of some form of profiling or discrimination. In this campaign, we have also heard, and I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden, I do not believe you are a racist, but I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. You also worked with them to oppose busing. You know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools, and she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me. So I will tell you that on this subject, it cannot be an intellectual debate among Democrats. We have to take it seriously. We have to act swiftly. As Attorney General of California, I was very proud to put in place a requirement that all my special agents would wear body cameras and keep those cameras on. Senator Harris, thank you. Vice President Biden, you have been invoked. We are going to give you a chance to respond.
And there's Kirsten Gillibrand. I want to talk. And Biden just sat there while the crowd cheered Kamala Harris.
It's a mischaracterization of my position across the board. I did not praise racist. That is not true, number one. Number two, if we want to have this campaign litigated on who supports civil rights and whether I did or not, I'm happy to do that.
Ay, 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 ay. Well, apparently he did it today, too. Biden, I'm sorry. He just looked like... one of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. Actually, there were a number of them on the stage last night, frankly, that didn't belong. But Joe Biden is, I think, toast. I think this did him in. Now, I got to say, though I thought Kamala Harris was the most effective on the stage last night, doesn't mean I'm ready to say I'm ready for Kamala Harris for president. Too many of the things I've heard about her time as both first district attorney, then attorney general of California, are disturbing. Her stance on a lot of policies as attorney general, going after parents for truant kids, a lot of things just rub me the wrong way. So as I have been doing with Elizabeth Warren, I am doing my homework and trying to learn more about Kamala Harris. But I think she's in this for the long run. I think a lot of the others are done. And all right, we're going to get Digby in a few minutes, but let me just say this before we get Digby on. And I know I'm going to shatter a lot of illusions. I was actually surprised to see the reaction to Bernie Sanders was so positive. I thought Bernie had a horrible night last night. His closing statement was good. But his answers were so almost robotic. It's the same. And I don't fault Bernie for having the same message he's had for decades. I think it's one of the great things about him is that he's been singing the same song for so long. He's consistent. He doesn't vacillate. He means what he says, and he says what he means. That said, he kept falling back. He was asked, and I wish my recording screwed up last night. So I usually record the whole thing, but I had something else running in the background, so I didn't have the full tape. But I have my notes, and oh my God, Peter Griffin in the YouTube chat room said, really? I thought Bernie rocked it all night. Some of my answers, my notes here are just weak answer. Oy is one that I wrote next to one of his. Sanders, his answer to the question about what would you do if you're president, and we know the court's been stacked with Trump picks right now. What would you do if Roe versus Wade was struck down during your administration? And Bernie sort of went into a whole diatribe of how he'd work to prop up Roe, and then he was asked the question again, saying, wait a minute, we're talking here. Let me just play it for you.
Third of all, I do not believe in packing the court. We got a terrible 5-4 majority conservative court right now. But I do believe that constitutionally we have the power to rotate judges to other courts. And that brings in new blood into the Supreme Court and a majority, I hope, that will understand that a woman has the right to control her own body and that corporations cannot run the
Senator,
United
I'm
States
gonna
of America.
Hold on, I'm going to give you 10 additional seconds.
And there's Kirsten Gillibrand trying to butt in again.
Has already overturned Roe, and Roe is gone. All of the things you just described would be to try to preserve Roe. If Roe is gone, what could you do as president abortion rights?
Well, first of all, let me tell you this. Didn't come up here, but let's face this. Medicare for all guarantees every woman in this country the right to have an abortion if she wants it.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay. I love you, Bernie, but that's wrong. If the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, it doesn't matter if we have Medicare for all or not. If the Supreme Court says a woman does not have a right to an abortion, although Roe v. Wade is about privacy issues and Fourth Amendment rights, it does impact abortion. Medicare for all would not guarantee that right if the Supreme Court doesn't give it. There were a few other troubling answers like that where it seems like he was pressed for time at the end and he'd fall back on his, you know, the corporations have to be reined in. I was deflated by his performance last night. I really was. And I fear, as much as I love Bernie Sanders and still think his ideas are the best, and it pains me to say this, as you can tell, I'm not sure that he's not too damaged. I'll leave it at that. And I mentioned she was coming to help us unpack what happened over the last couple of nights. We bring on the one and only Digby.
What's that, Leonardo? Who's Nicole Sandler's next guest? Why, it's Digby, of course. Who's Digby? Observe, Leonardo. That's dig for dig and B for B, Digby.
Digby, of course, has been blogging as the grand dam of the progressive blogosphere. Of course, you can always find her at her blog at digbysblog.blogspot.com. And, of course, at salon.com, where she writes a column a couple times a week. Hey, Digby.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I'm exhausted after the last two nights.
I know.
First of all, I got to ask, I thought the first night was, frankly, a more substantive and better debate because the candidates followed the rules. What is it with these people? Can't they see the clock and understand that 60 seconds means 60 seconds?
Well, you know what happened. It was after the first night, everybody gave Julian Castro and Bill de Blasio big props
right.
for interrupting.
Yeah.
So that was the lesson that everybody learned
oh
for the
God.
Second night was go ahead and jump right in. you know, it's a losing battle with that stuff because there's so many people and they're
too
all
many.
Just, you know, desperate for attention. And so they'll do whatever they have. And in fact, I think you're right about the fact that I think for a lot of viewers, the first debate may not have been quite as, you know, entertaining, but it was
right.
more educational
yeah.
about what they were, about what these people, you know, think about these issues. Whereas the second night, I mean, you could see the whole thing hurtling way out of control, and it was Kamala Harris who took back control of it and said, hey, you know, people don't want to see a food fight. They
yep.
want to see, you know, how you're going to put food on the table, which was, you know, a very smart way to kind of go, all right, everybody, get a hold of it. It made her seem authoritative, too. It was good.
Yes, it
her.
Did. No, in fact, here's that part you're talking about. You'll hear, it's not the whole thing, it's a 20-second clip, but you'll hear at least five of the candidates talking over each other.
Senator Harris, I'm so sorry. We will let all of you speak. Senator Harris.
Hey, guys, you know what? America does not want to witness a food fight. They want to know how we're going to put food on their table.
Yes. Great line. And you got to wonder, okay, did she
yeah,
have that
line.
One in her back pocket? She probably did.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, she probably did. She's very good at this. I mean, I think we can see that as long as Harris is in the race or if she goes all the way, that she's going to be good at debates. And she's good at this part of politics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a strength of hers. But we saw it in the hearings when she took on Bill Barr, one of the few to really draw blood from, you know, the fourth horseman of the apocalypse. and she's very good. And that was, she had several moments, as, you know, I'm sure we all know by now. But she that one was particularly good because it made her be the person who kind of, all right, boys, you know, come on.
Right.
Calm
well,
down
time to
now.
Get real.
Yeah, okay, kids, get back in your seats, you know,
right.
that kind of thing.
And that,
people respond to that. You
they
know?
Did. And that she was the one who called out Biden. The, you know, everyone was wondering, all right, who's going to take on Biden? A lot of people thought it was going to be Bernie Sanders. That she went for him on such an important issue is a big deal. And it's funny because I'm seeing the Biden bots out today big time on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And like one person tweeted to me that... let's see. This is a non-issue in 2020. Who the fuck cares about what Joe Biden did in 1970? Oh, yeah. The only one who cares is Kamala Harris because she has a personal grudge. The thing is, racism is a big deal in 2020. This is still an issue. And Joe Biden, I'm sorry, is an anachronism. He seems to live in the 70s. And I think it's time for him to go home. And apparently...
I'm sorry.
You, no, I guess he spoke at an Al Sharpton event today. And again,
yeah, I was at Jesse Jackson. Yeah.
Oh, a Jesse Jackson event. And I'm sorry. He just has here's a quote from Melissa McEwen, who said Biden is giving a civil rights address right now and just said, quote, that kid wearing a hoodie might be the next poet laureate and not a gangbanger. really?
You know, I mean, look, of course it speaks to the fact that, you know, Biden is just let's just put it this way. He's not exactly in touch with the zeitgeist,
no.
And I'm being kind by
mm-hmm.
saying that. But there's a bigger thing here that's going on, Nicole. In fact, I just read a really great article by Greg Sargent in the
yes.
Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
I posted about it on my blog. It'll go up later this afternoon. He made an observation that I think you really have to take seriously because this is what's really going on. We know that Joe Biden has missed a step. You know, that's pretty obvious. But all right, maybe that's forgivable. Is, you know, who cares? But more than that, you know, this idea that, you know, he's quite beloved in the black community for obvious reasons. He has been a proponent of civil rights. He was Barack Obama's vice president. I mean, there's a lot about him that I think that the African American community, particularly the older ones who've known him for a long time, appreciate. But what he's doing is an act of total cynicism. Because, as Greg Sargent points out, he has an internal contradiction in his election strategy, which is, one, to maintain the loyalty of the loyal black community that appreciates all that he's done and his vice presidency of Obama, being Obama's wingman. But he's also wanting to go to these white you know, Trump voters in
yeah.
places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and that. Well, you can't do that in this party. The Democratic Party can't do that anymore. If you want to see someone who's out of time, it's that. that is a non-negotiable position anymore. We don't do dog whistles on race in the Democratic Party anymore. And that's what he was doing way back when, by the way.
Yes.
When he was doing all this stuff with the busing and what have you. It was all about dog whistling white racists. No, Joe, you got to make a choice here. You don't get to have both, because that is just absolutely not going to work. And Democrats in this party are going to call him out for it over and over and over again. Those days are done. And just one more thing. You know, Democrats won over a lot of Republicans in 2018, and they didn't do it by doing that. They didn't have to do it. They didn't do dog whistles. What they did was they appealed to Republicans by saying, we're sane. And, you know, that we're not going to allow the Constitution to be destroyed. We're not going to allow our democracy to be degraded. We're not going to do all that. It wasn't particularly on policy. I'm talking about the Republican voters.
Okay.
A lot of Democrats and independents were won over by policy. But I'm just saying those Republicans that voted for Democrats, what got them was that they said there's one sane party in this country, and it isn't the Republicans. So I'm going to vote for the Democrats.
Right.
That is what happened there. Joe Biden is not going to get anybody on the basis of race. And I do believe that there's a cynical strategy at play where they're kind of wanting to leave that out there. You know, hey, you know, Joe was one of you guys. You know, look, they're not even doing it subtly, really. He's the guy from Scranton, right?
Yep.
The one
yep.
who can relate to all those Pennsylvania voters. Well, what is that really about?
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It was back in the 70s, and that's what it's about today. And that just, this is not, that is not the Democratic Party of 2019. And he doesn't seem to know that, and his people don't seem to know that. And I just don't think it's going to work. You can't get through this primary.
No.
And dog whistling racist,
right.
racist stuff. You
and,
can't.
And the thing is, instead of owning up to what he's done in the past, he's denying it. He's lying. So today, all of a sudden, these two letters surfaced from the 70s. Go figure. Here's one.
Yep.
United States Senate stationery, Joe Biden's a signature, written to the Honorable James O. Eastland, chairman of the committee, Judiciary Committee. Dear Mr. Chairman, as you will recall, last fall you supported S-1651, which Bill Roth and I authored to limit the use of busing as a remedy in school desegregation cases. Bill and I plan to attach S-1651 as approved by the Judiciary Committee as an amendment to blah, 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 blah. And then there's another one. Also written to Eastland, dear Mr. Chairman, I want you to know that I very much appreciate your help during this week's committee meeting in attempting to bring my anti-busing legislation to a vote. I am hopeful that the bill can be voted on at the next meeting, and with your assistance, I'm confident there is sufficient support for approval by the committee. Again, many thanks for your help, Joe Biden. Why is he lying about this?
Well, you know, he's lying and he isn't. He's, you know, he's trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
It's like I said, he wants that out there as being ambiguous. He wants to be able to maintain the African American voters who have liked him for good reason, while still reminding those white racist voters, you know, those Pennsylvania guys who, you know, apparently, you know, this is just the most important thing to them, that that he's one of them, and that he understands their concerns, and that he's, you know, just, hey, don't worry, you know, I'm good old Joe. You know, by the way, I don't think it'll work for them either. They've got Donald Trump. If that's what they want, they've got a guy to vote for. You know what I mean? I mean, they've got the real deal in Donald Trump. I mean, so, you know, Biden's weird sort of weaving, you know, trying to get to maintain this white working class support in this way. And it's not like he's making big. I mean, at least, I mean, I give credit, you know, people like Bernie and Warren and even some of the others on the stage. They are not writing those people off, but they're appealing to them on an economic basis, not on a racist basis.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, they're. I mean, I don't know that.
Well, there
be
are
successful.
Some. You know, there are the Steve Kings and the
oh my God.
You know, the Louis Gohmerts. The Republican Party is full of racists. They don't have to use dog whistles. They use the language. And speaking of racists, the Charlottesville guy who murdered Heather Heyer was sentenced to life in jail today. The thing is, these are also their constituents, so they don't have to use dog whistles. They're out there.
No, they don't. And And Trump's election really was the end of the dog whistle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the end of the dog whistle on both sides.
I think you're right.
We're going to have to speak in clear language now. You're going to have to say what you really think. People aren't going to put up with that anymore. And by the way, they're not doing it in the Republican Party either. As you point out, you know, they're just saying it right out now. And, mm-hmm. you know, look at what Trump said. I mean, you know, in his first day down the escalator, he was calling Mexicans rapists.
That's right.
You know, I mean, this isn't, you know, they're being much more upfront about it. And this is the way it's going to be. This is part of the polarization. And frankly, I think it's healthy. You know, this kind of trying to split the difference on these big moral issues that really divide the country, that is no way to do it. We've got to air this out. It's got to be aired out. It's got to be dealt with. You have to fight it out. Because if we don't, it festers, you know, it just mm-hmm. becomes this kind of, you know, infection that just sort of goes through the body politic. And so, you know, it's time for both parties, you know,
yep.
state your position and let's see where the American people fall. And, you know, I wish I was totally sure that most Americans would fall on my side. I'm not either. But I think that, you know, we have to. You know, take a stand and try and persuade them, or, you know, but do it in an honest way. I mean, we have to say what we really stand for. And you know, in my heart of hearts, I still think that most people are, you know, pretty decent people. And I, you know, we've got a lot of structural things that are impediments to making that case. I mean, God, look at the right-wing media. It's basically just a propaganda machine. It's a brainwashing machine.
Yes.
So we have a lot to go up against, but I do think it's possible. I mean, I think, and we have to try, right? I mean,
well,
what are we
going to
do, just let them run
over? No, we have to try. But it sometimes feels, Digby, like we're banging our heads against the wall. You know, you mentioned the right-wing media. We expect these things out of Fox and Sinclair and the new One America News, which is trying to be the next Fox. There's tons of right-wing hate talk formats out there on radio, on television. We're inundated with them. What there's not a lot of are progressive voices, frankly. We sort of default to MSNBC because they used to try to be the, you know, the antidote to Fox. Not anymore. They are now the channel. I've decided what they are is they're the place for the never Trumpers of the Republican Party. They're definitely anti-Trump. But they're in no way progressive, and they're not even necessarily Democratic-leaning. They're more, you know, Bill Kristol and David Jolly and Charlie Sykes and Jennifer Rubin and Nicole Wallace. And I could keep going on and on and on because their channel is inundated by these former Republicans or still current Republicans, just never Trumpers. They're not catering to us. They're not on our side. And it's very evident by, number one, how awful they are to Bernie Sanders, which gets, you know, my shackles up. And number two, how they're leaning so heavy on the scale for Joe Biden and Mayor Pete, for whatever reason I can't figure out. We don't have an objective news source in this country. And it's really frustrating for someone who wants objective news. I don't want their opinions. I want news. And it seems to not exist in this country anymore.
Well, I think what's happened is that we ended up having, you know, we're all sort of, you know, searching. I mean, I know you probably have a list of bookmarks that you check every day trying to sort of see where the progressive line of thought is and get new ideas about, you know, how to think about things. We're inundated with a lot of information, but of course, as you point out, it's not necessarily news, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
it's just a cacophony of sound, and
yep.
we're trying to sort through it. And that really is, that's tough, and it's gotten tougher in the last few years because many of the progressive outlets that were out there, you know, they sort of failed or moderated in some way. And I'm not really sure I understand. I mean, maybe you can tell me, why is it that progressive journalism, you know, forthright progressive, well, you know, progressive media in general. Why is it that we don't have more of it?
I think because...
I mean, other than the obvious corporate,
money,
you know,
right.
sponsorship.
It's a money thing. There are some fabulously wealthy people on the left. Tom Steyer is a great example. He's pouring billions of dollars into this need to impeach organization. Really, I mean, first he started up a Next Gen, which was an organization dealing with climate change. Great cause to throw your money into. I think that the need to impeach thing is a vanity project to build his email list. Can you imagine if he'd spent all the money that he's put out to run TV ads on the need to impeach Donald Trump, which we already know we need to impeach him, if he put that into progressive media? If he bankrolled a network, for instance, there's so much money on the right supporting their hate talk voices. And on the left, even though there are wealthy people like Tom Steyer, like Nick Hanauer, like George Soros. Sorry, I've never gotten my George Soros check, despite what the right wing media will tell you.
You haven't?
No. Have you gotten yours?
Goodness. Of course I got mine.
Really?
You know, I'm a millionaire.
Of
I'm just pretending
you
to be, you know, living
right.
hand to mouth.
Yeah, we don't
to keep anybody from knowing.
Right. We don't have those media benefactors on the left. That's why I'm constantly begging. My show is 100% listener supported. I need your help to keep doing this. They don't have those problems. The reason why their books are always at the top of the bestseller list is because their organizations buy them up in bulk and they hand them out as premiums to people
That's
who give
right.
donations. We don't have those fairy godmothers or fathers or sugar daddies on the left. We really could use a few of them.
Well, I can think of one, and I'll just bring it up because I think it's interesting, Pierre Omidyar, who started The
Intercept. The Intercept, right. Yep.
And that is one, and I think they've done pretty well. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, I think it's a pretty influential website, and I think there's some international aspects of it,
mm-hmm.
too. I think they have
they're in Brazil, things. For sure, with Glenn.
And it's true that they had a very sort of specific focus, at least in the beginning, which was they were, you know, because of the Snowden stuff, that they were going to be doing civil liberties,
right.
you know, would be their focus. But there's a lot of politics there now.
Yes, there is.
Brian Grimm is, I think, their political editor, and they have, you know, a lot, and a lot of good writers over there.
Right.
So it just goes to show, honestly, I don't know what the financial aspect of that is.
Mehdi Hasan does a podcast over there, but... you know, and it's great for them. And so we have The Intercept. It's
but
one
it's a model, right?
Right.
I mean,
I guess.
Couldn't that model be purposed to others? I mean, you know, couldn't Tom Steyer start an Intercept?
Why
something,
not?
You know?
He should.
I don't know.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Is there is money on the left, not as much, I believe, as on the right, but the money interests on the left do not support independent progressive media, which is, you know, this is just one of my pet peeves. It's a travesty.
Well, of course, mine too.
Right.
Mine too. And it's very interesting because when we getting back to the conversation, you know, about the presidential race, it just shows there's an asymmetric political system that we have. We have one that has a dedicated partisan media, and a very lockstep kind of constituency. You know, these are people, I mean, you can just, you know that there's, Donald Trump has proved one thing about the Republican Party. There is no ideology.
Right.
It's not about,
none at all.
You know, no, it's not about, you know, Milton Friedman or, you know, Hayek or, you know,
nope.
any of the, you know, Burke or Hume or Kant or whatever it was. You know, that is not what they're about. And they tried to create this ideology that would sort of encompass what they were really about, which is basically just, you know, come on, it's traditional white patriarchy.
Yeah, and it's enrich yourself. It's about covering your ass.
Christian patriarchy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, yeah, so you know, that's they developed this, you know, so-called ideology, the conservative movement. Well, the minute that Donald Trump, but you know, the and a very very effective demagogue who was also a TV celebrity and, you know, someone who had a you know, who you have to give him credit. He certainly has a way of grabbing one's attention.
Mm-hmm.
All of that ideology fell away. They didn't care about any of it. You know,
Nothing.
None of that matters. What
Nothing.
Matters, you know, is you know, sort of feeding their id, you know, the lizard brain of the right wing. And he does that better than anybody. So that's where they are. So it's not really, it's not about that. In that sense, it's not really a clash of ideas with the Republicans. I mean, it's one of the things that drives me nuts about the about what, you know, what we see the machinations in the House. For instance, this thing that happened this week with the border, you know, with the border bill for the humanitarian aid.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Democrats in the Senate, you know, they basically, you know, kneecapped the House by passing it by a huge margin, the Republican bill.
Yeah, it was like 84 to 8. It was crazy. And so they had no choice but to go back and pass the Senate version. What is Chuck Schumer's problem? Does he not understand how these things work?
And it's just how do these things, you know, even let's just forget, you know, look, the House is passing a lot of bills and they're symbolic bills. They're not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. But these are good for people's resume. They can say they voted for this, that and the other and
right.
whatever. It's and show the American people what it is they really stand for, what their aspirations are. I'm all for it. But they don't really mean anything. This particular bill has the benefit of being a symbolic bill in that it was about, you know, helping these little children, basically. I mean, it's this horrible story of concentration camps on the border in which, you know, children as young as toddler age.
Even younger,
being, you know,
4 months.
Even younger.
As young as four months.
They're being mistreated and not taken care of, and it is a moral blight on this country. And even a lot of conservatives are really, even some of the ones who, you know, you might expect otherwise, are kind of going, ooh, that, boy, that's bad. You know, mm-hmm. It's a sickening thing. And there the Democrats would have had a chance to hold up, you know, and Pelosi had been negotiating at the White House, and there was a bunch of stuff apparently in the works, and the Senate came in and did this and kind of interrupted whatever she might have had going. And I don't know if she would have succeeded, but they were working
on
it.
I don't know either.
And basically they empowered the moderates in the House caucus to stand up and go, okay, well, we're going to vote with the Republicans, you know, if you do this. And so that's what that killed it. You know, we're back with the blue dog dynamic.
Yeah.
You remember that as well as I do, right? Over the years.
Of course.
It was always them who had the veto power over anything.
Yep.
Whereas they could have stood up and made a stand on this and gone, you know, this could have been a moment for them to illustrate for the American people. Look, we're not asking for anything. We want this money to help those kids, but Donald Trump is going to be held accountable. That's what you sent us here last November, and that is what we're demanding in this bill, and we have to have it. And, you know, they of course it would have been rough. Of course Trump would have called them, you know, said it was their fault and called them, you know, baby killers and God knows what else. I mean, so what? Have the fight. You know, that's where we're at. We have to fight these things. And it's just so disappointing to me to see this dynamic just, you know, replayed over and over
again.
Horrible. And it's a, you know, it's a weakness in the Democrats in that they're not seeing the fact, in my view, that this is a fight and we're going to have to wage it.
And if you... Along those lines, the same thing with Pelosi dragging her feet on opening an impeachment inquiry.
Of course.
What the hell is she waiting for? I, it's just so frustrating. As you said, Digby, they were voted, the Democrats were voted into the majority to perform oversight on this criminal administration, and they're not being allowed to do it. And she's sort of going, oh, well, I mean, thank goodness for Nadler and Schiff, who at least finally issued a subpoena for Mueller. Because if that hadn't happened before they left for 4th of July, I don't know, I would have been apoplectic already. At least there's something here. At least we know Mueller is now going to testify on July 17th. But up until that time, Hope Hicks wants to testify in a closed session. Okay. The attorneys object to every question she's asked. Okay. The American people don't know because the hearing wasn't televised. Do something about it. I think the American people are going to get so frustrated with the Democrats that they're going to stay home.
Well, it's certainly possible. And it's certainly possible that whatever, you know, swing voters exist. I mean, you know, it was a close election last time. You know, Trump barely eked out a win across three states in very small numbers. It would be really great if it wasn't that close this time. It shouldn't be. He's got a 40% approval rating. There's
exactly.
no reason for the Democrats to have to fear this. But because he is being allowed to get away with this stuff, that we're watching him just, he's Teflon. I mean, he was incredibly accused of rape this week.
Exactly.
And it's like nothing. It's a tiny little story that basically went, you know.
Hey, again,
gone.
The
and
president of the United States was accused of rape. This is not someone saying he fondled me. He was accused of rape, and at first the New York Times didn't even put it in the newspaper section. It was in the book review section.
And you know, this is, it's outrageous, and here's the problem. The problem is that it's making him look, you know, strong. It makes him look impervious. And you know, for a lot of people, that is an attractive quality right. in a leader. They
yep.
can't get him. They can't take him down, or they won't, or they're too scared, or they're too, you know, they've got their own, they're just, you know, running around in circles. I mean, that is, that's what scares me. It scares me, not so much that I think that most, you know, decent people in this country are going to say, oh, I can't stand this guy. We got to get rid of him. I don't care what the deal is. I'm doing it. You know, they, I mean, I've often said, you know, I would vote for a doorknob. Over,
right.
I'd vote for Richard Nixon's corpse
yes.
over Donald Trump. But, you know, most of us are you know, in that position. But it was a close election last
yep.
time. And
yep.
we have got to, you can't allow people, there's some guy who's sitting there going, yeah, you know, I don't know. We've got, you know, say Bernie on one hand, we've got Trump on the other. Man, that Trump looks strong. Nobody can get him, you know. No, they have to show that he's not strong. He's weak. He's vulnerable. He's a con man.
Right, and he's not above the law. He is accountable to the rule of law. And the thing
yes.
is, we can say it as much as we want. If the Democrats don't prove it and hold him accountable under the rule of law, then he does get away with murder. Then he can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any supporters. This is why it's so important that he's held to account for his crimes. And for Nancy Pelosi to say, I'm not there yet, I think it's time for her
What's
to go.
What's it going to take?
Yeah, that's what you know, I'd like to know.
What's it going to take? I mean, he can rape someone on Fifth Avenue. That's
yeah.
where Bergdorf Goodman
that's
is
right.
on Fifth Avenue.
That's right.
And he won't lose any voters. We know that much. Now, I don't know if he actually has killed anyone, but, you know, I think it's fair to say that if he did, he's right. He wouldn't lose any voters. I mean, and that's because nobody is, you know, because there, a lot of Americans like a strong guy in charge, and he's proving to them that he is, and it's not true. He isn't strong. They're letting him do it. It's not that. And look, as far as just to one final point, the impeachment may not, he may not, they may not get a conviction in the Senate.
Right.
I doubt they will.
No.
I'm almost 99% sure that they won't.
Me too.
But let those people run on that. Lay out that case and then go, look, this guy over here voted to keep this rapist, this corrupt rapist, traitorous, you know, imbecile in office. This guy over here voted for him. He you saw the case, you know what's out there, and he voted for him. I think they should have to defend that vote. I want them to defend that acquittal.
You and me
if
both.
That's what they do.
You and me both. In the meantime, the hearings will be televised, and the American people will hear for themselves
yeah.
what this president is guilty of, and that's what it's going to
exactly.
take. That's where we are. And so they can hold all the hearings they want. If they're not televised and if they're behind closed doors, they do us no good. Because Fox is, and the Attorney General and all of Trump's stooges are going to keep insisting, no collusion, no obstruction. And the idiots out there are going to believe it. Because as we've heard some people at town hall saying, this is the first time I've heard that he's done anything wrong. Because they watch Fox where they're lied to consistently.
Yeah.
And so people who get their so-called news from Fox don't know what he's guilty of. We need to educate the rest of the country, and this is the only
Absolutely.
Way to do it. All right, Digby, we've run long, but I'm going late today anyway. One last question. Did you hear anybody on either of the last two nights in the debates who give you hope? Is there anyone who stood out to you, anyone surprised you, anyone that you're now taking a second look at?
Well, you know, I'm probably not the best person to ask that because I follow it so closely,
mm-hmm.
as do you.
Yes.
So, you know, it's hard to be surprised
right.
by these things. I did think that Harris showed herself to be a very effective person in this format, and I think I mentioned earlier, you know, her questioning during the hearings, I think, also showed
yes.
that she has a prosecutorial talent that might carry over well to dealing with Trump. So I was kind of glad to see that.
Right. Although it could work against her, as a lot of people, a lot of especially progressives, their line is
right.
she's a cop. She was a prosecutor. She did a lot of stuff that we're not proud of, we're not happy about. So there is a record there to examine. And some things as Attorney General of California are not necessarily.
She has to answer for all
yes,
of that.
Yes, she
has
does.
To answer for all of that. And
Thank
she's going to have to walk that line, as will all of these,
right.
these people
exactly.
with their records.
Yep.
You know, I'm a big, big fan of Elizabeth Warren.
Me too.
And I've been a fan of hers for years.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed her on an online chat some years back, and I've met her a couple of times in small meetings. And she's wonderful, and she did not let me down on the first night.
No,
she was great.
So I thought she was too.
I was thrilled to see her in there, and you know, I, there are there, as far as policy goes, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, she and Sanders obviously hold down the left end,
yep.
And I'm always interested to hear that. So, you know, look, like I said, I'll vote for Richard Nixon's court. So, you know, I hope to get the best candidate, one that can win, and one that represents my values. And you know, we'll see this. We're early on, so
yes.
You know, I'm hopeful.
We got a lot of time.
I think we have a good deep bench, and I'm happy to see them all up there, you know, talking about what they're talking about.
Absolutely, Digby. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for helping me wrap up this week. Truly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I hope everyone will go visit your blog because it is truly one of the best out there. Digby'sblog.blogspot.com. Of course, read Digby at Salon.
Thank you.
And follow her on Twitter at Digby56. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thanks, Nicole.
I really appreciate
Happy 4th.
Thank you. You too. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. As I said, there's so much content today, so little time, so we are running a little long today because I told you we had the interview with Jamie Raskin that I'm going to play for you the second half. And I've also got some clips from the debate last night, should you care to hear anything. I'll tell you what, I'd even open up the phone lines. I'm going to hang out for a while. 954-889-6410 is the number. You can Skype into Nicole Sandler, should you care. All right. You know what? Let's go back and finish up the interview with Jamie Raskin, because I'm really impressed with this guy. And I'm thrilled that he's in leadership because we need more progressives in leadership. So once again, we started the program at the top of the last hour with Jamie Raskin, congressman from Maryland's 8th congressional district, now in his second term, running for re-election, of course, and who has ascended to leadership and is a very strong progressive voice in leadership. We need more like him there. All right, back to my interview with Jamie Raskin from this morning. Raskin, Donald Trump is in Japan today for the G20. There's video of him joking with Vladimir Putin about not meddling in our elections because he thinks it's a joke, and also wishing the press didn't exist. It's just ridiculous. So my next question and my biggest question for you is, you are in, as we discussed, leadership in the House. I think you're the senior whip of the House Democratic Caucus. Are you counting votes as to how many Congress members are in favor of opening an impeachment inquiry? Where are we on this?
We passed on the House yesterday the SAFE Act, which is a requirement of a voter-verified paper ballot in every state in the union. We also passed hundreds of millions of dollars to go out to the states through the Election Assistance Commission to toughen up our cyber defenses against penetration of the voter systems. We know that Putin's team tried to get into more than 30 state election systems. Ooh. In addition to all of the hacking they did at the DNC and the DCCC and Hillary Clinton's offices and the cyber propaganda through Facebook and so on, they tried to get directly into the election machines. And all we heard from the Republicans, well, they didn't succeed, as if they wanted to wait for a round where they do succeed in determining the mathematical counts. I mean, it's a plainly unacceptable situation. But we have a philosophical difference with them. They were saying, well, we should just leave it to the states to defend themselves. They're perfectly able to defend themselves. To which I said, look, we might have good police forces across the country, but we still have a national defense system. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Constitution in Article 4, Section 4, guarantees to every state in the union a Republican form of government, which not Republican Party form of government, but a representative form of government, which means that Congress has to make sure that the people are actually governing. And so this is doing our minimal constitutional duty. And yet still the Republicans seem to be following Donald Trump, who says that this is, he calls it still the Russian hoax. He refuses to acknowledge what Special Counsel Mueller found, what the intelligence agencies found, and which everybody can see what's plain to the eye, which is there was a sweeping and systematic campaign to subvert and undermine our election.
Right. Okay. So I fully agree on every front. Donald Trump is obviously thumbing his nose at all of that, joking with Putin about interfering in our elections. It's not okay. So the question is, I don't understand, especially in the wake of the obstruction on people who have testified in the Mueller probe coming to testify before Congress, why an impeachment inquiry has not yet been begun. Where are we on that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I called for launching an impeachment inquiry several months ago, mm-hmm. and every day more and more members, Democrats and one Republican, Justin Amash, have come out saying that they've seen enough evidence from the Mueller report and from the Trump administration's defiance of Congress at every turn in investigations and from the blatant open-air violations of the Emoluments Clause, that there is enough evidence to justify launching an impeachment inquiry. And, you know, the arguments that I've heard from colleagues opposed to it are not that there are not high crimes and misdemeanors visible to the naked eye, but simply that the politics are such that it doesn't make sense because he would not be convicted in the Senate. Or, you know, maybe the politics of it would be awkward for the 2020 race. Those are legitimate, if minor, considerations. I think we've got a constitutional duty of our own to do. And, you know, when the impeachment inquiry launched against Richard Nixon, he was very high up in the polls. But as people learned the truth of his administration about the corruption and the obstruction there, they turned on him, including the Republicans. So, you know, I hope that some Republicans would do their job. But in any event, we've got to do ours.
Right. So is Nancy Pelosi dead set against doing this? I don't understand what the hesitation is. Can you shine some light on
that? I mean, no, I think that, you know, one of the political functions of Speaker of the House is to protect and expand the Democratic majority. And so she's concerned about, you know, the 30 or 35 members who are in the most swing districts, many of them districts that went for Donald Trump. I don't think that she's dead set opposed to it in any way. I think she wants to make sure that we're proceeding as deliberately, as methodically, and as cautiously as possible. So I think she's been doing a good job on this, but we do have to move quickly over the summer. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, the last I heard, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 or so members of the Democratic caucus who have come out publicly in favor of opening an impeachment inquiry. Do you know how accurate that number is, and how many more are, you know, privately in favor of it but not willing to make the public stance yet?
Well, I think it might be over 80 now. But look, I mean, the moment that Speaker Pelosi decides that she thinks the time is right, I think the support will be overwhelming. It'll be over 200 members,
yes,
you know.
I agree.
So the impeachment clauses repose the power of impeachment of a president for high crimes and misdemeanors with Congress, not with the courts. If it were a purely legal question, it would just be up to the courts. It's up to Congress. So we do have to take into account political judgments about what it does for the country and what it does in terms of other agendas we're working on. So, you know, she's got a complicated job, but I'm a member of the Judiciary Committee and the Oversight Committee. And I've seen enough. This administration is completely lawless and they're acting in utter defiance of the separation of powers and the constitutional design every single day when they deny us witnesses, when they deny us documents. I mean, yesterday I chaired an oversight hearing for a while about the GSA and whether they're doing proper oversight of the Trump Hotel. And they're not turning documents over to us. But we know of, 24 foreign governments that Donald Trump has collected money from while he's been president of the United States. That's naked violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause, which says that none of us can accept money. A present, an emolument, which means a payment, an office, a title of any kind, whatever, from a foreign government without getting the consent of Congress. And he's never asked for our consent. He's just made one voluntary payment to the Treasury saying this is the profits from his business with foreign governments. But, you know, the Constitution doesn't say you can't take profits from foreign governments. It says you can't take payments of any kind, whatever, and you can't take any of it without the consent of Congress.
Right. And so we're seeing this guy just completely obliterate the rule of law. He thumbs his nose at it. He should be removed from office. Do you, in private, do you hear from Republican colleagues who know what a stain on the American fabric Donald Trump is, but they're afraid to say anything publicly? I don't understand why Republicans are so intractable on the issue, why they're standing up against the rule of law to protect this guy.
Well, I don't want to completely lionize or heroize Justin Amash, but this is the reason why he does give me some hope,
yes,
because he's a Republican from a very Republican district. And he went out to his town hall meeting and he said he read the Mueller report and he saw lots of evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors, and the judgment is inescapable. So, look, I'm afraid that large parts of the Republican Party, most of the Republican Party now, is operating like a religious cult. Mm. And it's like a religious cult surrounding a white-collar organized crime family with Donald Trump as the boss. I've never seen anything like it in my life. They've completely suspended critical judgment. So if he wakes up and he says the dictator of North Korea is our best friend, then he's our best friend. If he wakes up the next day and says he wants to move towards nuclear war against North Korea, then they go with that. In other words, they don't exercise any critical scrutiny at all of anything the president is saying.
Yep. I hear you. I know I've kept you on way too long. One final question for you. Former President Jimmy Carter this morning said in an answer to a question from John Meacham that basically that Donald Trump is an illegitimate president. This is, I think, a new precedent. I don't think any sitting president has ever said that of any former president has said that of a sitting president. Do you think we're going to turn a corner on this guy, or is he just going to keep thumbing his nose at the rule of law and norms and government and disassembling our democracy for the next year and a half?
Well, yes, I think Trump has made that clear. I mean, for his entire life, he's never had any respect for the rule of law. He's never had respect for other people's rights. He doesn't pay his contractors, his painters. He doesn't pay the carpenters, the electricians, or the plumbers. He assaults women at free will whenever he wants. He rapes women. He jokes about it, saying they're not his type. Look, we know who he is. I think that's well established. The terrifying thing is that you have a whole political party that has organized itself around an essentially deranged and lawless individual who acts in contempt of our Constitution every single day. So we got to deal with that problem. But the good news is in 2018, we got 9.5 million more votes than they did in congressional elections across America. 9.5 million more votes. We can double that in 2020 based on all of the people who've turned 18, just the young people coming in who all, you know, detest the Trump administration. But we got to organize. We got to mobilize people. And even though the Republicans are hanging on by their fingernails because of every undemocratic institution in the country, from the Electoral College to gerrymandering to corporate money made possible by Citizens United and the Supreme Court they gerrymandered, we still will be able to swamp them in the 2020 elections. But it is the election of our lifetime.
It most definitely is. Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. As I said, I've been following you since you arrived in Congress, since Howie Klein and Blue America endorsed you, actually. I'm just so thrilled that you're in Congress representing all of us, even though you represent Maryland.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you for having me. I'd love to come back, and I promise it'll be under better auditory conditions than the airport.
It sounds great. I will hold you to that. Congressman Raskin, thank you so much. It was great talking
with
you.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. I've been looking forward to talking with him, as I just said, for a long time, and he's impressive. I think he's one to look out for, Congressman Jamie Raskin. All right, it is the extended disco version of the show, the Friday edition. So we had Digby on, we had Jamie Raskin on. Before, I had to stop with the recap of yesterday's last night's debate to get Digby on the line. I was going over some of the clips. We'll go through a little more just in case you didn't watch it. I can share the things that I pulled from it anyway. So I played the clip, the moment, the 5 minutes of Kamala Harris going after Joe Biden, calling him out for his stance on busing back in the 70s. Look, Joe Biden has a lot of very questionable history. In fact, that wasn't the only issue he was pressed on. His vote on going to war in Iraq was an issue.
You have made your decades of experience in foreign policy a pillar of your campaign. But when the time came to say yes or no on one of the most consequential foreign policy decisions of the last century, you voted for the Iraq War. You have since said you regret that vote. But why should voters trust your judgment when it comes to making a decision about taking the country to war the next time?
Because once Bush abused that power, what happened was we got elected after that. I made sure
president turned to me and said, Joe, get our combat troops out of Iraq. I was responsible for getting 150,000 combat troops out of Iraq, and my son was one of them. I also think we should not have combat troops in Afghanistan. It's long overdue. It should end. And thirdly, I believe that you're not going to find anybody who has pulled together more of alliances to deal with what is the real stateless threat out there. We cannot go it alone in terms of dealing with terrorism. So I'd eliminate the act that allowed us to go into war and not the AUMF, and make sure that it could only be used for what its intended was, what its intent was, and that is to go after terrorists, but never do it alone. That's why we have to repair our alliances. We put together 65 countries to make sure we dealt with ISIS in Iraq and other places. That's what I would do. That's what I have done, and I know how to do it.
He knows how to do it. Hey, so that was Joe Biden's answer on Iraq. Of course, then they went to Bernie Sanders for a response.
Senator Sanders, 30 seconds.
One of the differences that Joe and I have in our record is Joe voted for that war. I helped lead the opposition to that war, which is a total disaster. Second of all, I helped lead the effort for the first time to utilize the War Powers Act to get the United States out of the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen, which is the most horrific humanitarian disaster.
Yes, he did.
And thirdly, let me be very clear. I will do everything I can to prevent a war with Iran, which would be far worse than disastrous war with
Senator
Iraq.
Senator Sanders, thank you.
Absolutely. And can I tell you what else was just amazing? They didn't talk about Iran at all in this debate. Then again, they spent about 5 minutes on climate change. So tells you that. Chuck Todd, who had no business being on that debate stage either night, he went from bad to worse. Last night, on the first night, he did one lightning round, you know, going down the line, trying to get everyone to answer with a one word answer. Didn't work out too well. So he did a bunch of them last night. Seriously, this crew last night did not understand how to follow instructions. Now, Andrew Yang, who got the least amount of talk time of anyone, he had like 2.5 minutes. That was it. He's saying that his mic was shut off. He's saying there were a few times he attempted to interject like everyone else on the stage was doing, and his mic was off. Just saying. They called on him, I think, once. But maybe what they should have done is when the 30 seconds or 60 seconds that they had for each answer was up, cut off their mics. Instead, he had Kirsten Gillibrand, who kept on talking and talking and talking past the allotted 60-second time, and then trying to butt in every time someone else was asked a question. It was so annoying. I didn't like her to begin with. I like her even less now. But I thought I'd play one of these lightning rounds for you. So here's a lightning round, okay? This one was the first thing you would tackle when you get into office January 21st, 2021. Of course, I'm going to have to stop it a few times in the middle because so many of these answers were just so frustrating. It starts with, I believe, Eric Swalwell.
For Parkland, yep. For Orlando, for every community affected by gun violence, ending gun violence.
Okay. Senator Bennett.
I like that. So Bennett of Colorado.
Climate change and the lack of economic mobility Bernie talks about.
Good. Like that. Good.
Passing a family bill of rights that includes a national paid leave plan, universal pre-K.
One word.
Affordable daycare.
One
and
word.
Making sure that women
Kristen.
And families can thrive
Kirsten,
in the workplace no
whatever
matter who they
is.
Are.
One word.
I like that.
That was
okay.
Pretty good. Senator
I'm
Harris.
Then. So
Harris.
Passing a middle class and working families tax cut.
That's one.
DACA.
Oh,
guns.
My God.
Okay. I'm giving you credit for the first thing you said, the tax cut. I got you.
Hold on.
That there's only one or two issues out there.
All right, I just have to pause it here because really, so Kamala Harris couldn't come up with one thing. She tried to get, to follow Kirsten Gillibrand, who is an idiot who doesn't know how to say a one-word answer. So Kamala Harris decides to go down that road. But her first one is a tax cut? Seriously? See, this is why I have problems with Kamala Harris. Her first priority with everything else that's going on is a middle class tax cut. Bernie Sanders' answer wasn't a whole lot better, but at least he said, I can't just come up with one thing. They weren't asking you, what one thing will you do? What will you tackle first was the question. I admit, it's a stupid question. All of their questions pretty much were kind of stupid, especially the ones that Chuck Todd asked. But, you know, these are the rules. So they ask the questions. You got to try to answer them as they ask them.
This I'm not saying there isn't one or two.
Enormous crises.
Senator
we
Sanders.
Need a political revolution. People have got to stand up and take on the special interest. We can transform this country.
All right. You know I love Bernie Sanders. But that answer sucked. What is the first issue you tackle? And Bernie says, well, there's more than one thing. There's too many things. And Toad says, well, just what is the first thing you tackle? And then Bernie reverts to, we need a political revolution. He goes on autopilot at the wrong times. Just saying, still love my Bernie, but he just, I don't think he was very strong last night. Just saying, and it worries me. Just getting it out there.
Vice President Biden, your first issue, Mr. Vice President.
I think you're so underestimating what Barack Obama did. He's the first man to bring together the entire world.
That wasn't the question. The question was, what is the first thing you're going to tackle as president of the United States? And he goes, I think Barack Obama doesn't get enough credit. My buddy Barack, he was the president. You don't give him credit for the good things he did. That doesn't answer the question.
96 nations to commit to deal with climate change immediately.
Okay. Couldn't you just say climate change?
The first thing I would do is make sure that we defeat Donald Trump.
Wait a minute. No, the first thing you do when you take office, technically you would have already defeated Donald Trump. Joe, go home. Play with your grandchildren. End this charade now. Joe Biden, if you stay in this race, if you become the nominee, we will lose and be subject to 4 more years or more of Donald Trump. Please go home. What's the first thing you do? I'd make sure Donald Trump is kicked out of the office. You will have already beaten him. Or frankly, no, you won't. If you're the nominee, we lose. Okay, back to the lightning round.
Mayor Buttigieg, your first priority, your first issue as president that you are going to block and tackle.
We've got to fix our democracy before it's too late. Get that right, climate, immigration.
Fix our democracy. Wow, there's a specific.
Mr. Yang.
Huh?
I would pass a $1,000 freedom dividend for every American adult starting at age 18.
He's consistent.
Which would speed us up on climate change, because if you get the boot off of people's throats, they'll focus on climate change much more clearly.
Governor Hickenlooper?
I would do a collaborative approach to climate change, and I would pronounce it well before the election to make sure we don't reelect the worst president in American history.
And Ms. Williamson
with
the last word.
My first call is to Prime Minister of New Zealand.
What?
Who said that her goal is to make New Zealand the place where it's the best place in the world for a child to grow up. And I will tell her, girlfriend, you are so on, because the United States of America is going to be the best place in the world for a child to grow up.
You guys were close with the short, at least it was shorter.
Okay. Marianne Williamson, I got to say, I love her. that was a non sequitur. That was an amazing answer. I must say, that was an amazing answer. What's the first thing you would do? The first person I'd call is the Prime Minister of New Zealand, because she says that's the best place to raise a kid. And I'm going to say, you're wrong, girlfriend. The best place to raise a kid is the United States of America. But I got to tell you, she made some sense, too. Everyone's making fun of her. But just listen to her on the border to detainments issue.
Donald Trump has done to these children, and it's not just in Colorado. Governor, you're right. It is kidnapping, and it's extremely important for us to realize that. If you forcibly take a child from their parents' arms, you are kidnapping them. And if you take a lot of children and you put them in a detainment center, thus inflicting chronic trauma upon them, that's called child abuse.
Yes,
this
it is
collective child abuse. And when this is crime, both of those things are a crime. And if your government does it, that doesn't make it less of a crime. These are state-sponsored crimes. What President Trump has done is not only attack these children, not only demonize these immigrants, he is attacking a basic principle of America's moral core. We open our hearts to the stranger. This is extremely important. And it's also important for all of us to remember, and I have great respect for everyone who is on this on this on this stage, but we're going to talk about what to do about health care. Well, where have you been, guys? Because if it's not just a matter of a plan, and I haven't heard anybody on this stage who has talked about American foreign policy in Latin America and how we might have, in the last few decades, contributed to something being more.
Okay, so she made some really good points. She talked about some things that nobody else did. Unfortunately, most people couldn't see through her new agey kind of aura. But I like Marianne Williamson. She will never be president. But you know what? I like her wrapping everything in love. It's unrealistic, but in today's day and age, we need that kind of energy. We just really, really do. All right. There's more stuff I could... I mentioned in the interview with Jamie Raskin that Jimmy Carter had said that this presidency, that Donald Trump was an illegitimate president. I want to share with you the audio clip because it's quite stunning, I think. I don't know what the occasion was. Jimmy Carter was being interviewed by John Meacham. And this, it's a, just a less than a minute long clip, but it's really good. Here's what happened.
Russia has been proven by our intelligence community to have interfered with one of our human rights, which is the right of free and fair elections. Mm-hmm. What's your reaction? How should we deal with Russia?
Well, the president himself should condemn it, admit that it happened, which I think 16 of our intelligence agencies have already agreed to say. And there's no doubt that the Russians did interfere in the election. And I think the interference, although not yet quantified, if fully investigated, would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf.
Ah.
So do you believe President Trump is an illegitimate president?
Based on what I just said, which I can't retract.
Touché. Based on what I just said, which I can't retract, yeah. Donald Trump is an illegitimate president. We need him out of office. So my take on the debates, I was very impressed with Elizabeth Warren. I still love Bernie Sanders, even though I thought he was not good last night. I still have issues with Kamala Harris, but thought she won the night last night, and think most of the candidates on the stage need to go home and let us have a serious debate in July. But we'll still have too many people. All right. Have a great weekend, everyone. Happy 4th of July weekend. Oh, it's not 4th of July till like Thursday next week. We got time. I'll see you Tuesday right back here on the Nicole Sandler Show. Thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks for coming back for the special extended disco version of the show. Until Tuesday, have a great weekend, everyone.